take me down. Love, take me down. Wear a pair of lonely ones can always be. Love, take me down. Love, take me down where I'm longing to be. Love, take me down to the streets. Love, take me down to the streets. This money don't get fed at home, so gotta give the dog his bone. Take that love into the streets. Come on.
Hey, dude.
Hey, dude. What's up?
Not much.
I'm sorry. I was saying that because I started to say hi before I even unmuted myself, and I felt like an idiot.
That's fine.
Still don't know how it works. Yeah. I thought at first, Ryan, I thought your Miller's Outpost shirt said Miller's Crossing. I was
that actually would be really awesome. Oh my God. To have a Miller's Crossing shirt in the style of Miller's Outpost in that typeface. Ralph, can you make that happen, please?
I can. You want me to?
Will you make that happen?
Recording in progress.
Got it.
Okay. You know, I got to say, we've come a long way with the recording in progress voice. I think we've made great strides. At first, Ralph was terrified of it.
Sure.
He said he heard it in his mind all the time. And now we just accept it. We move on. We've become trained.
Desensitized.
Yeah, we let the computer run our lives.
Yes.
As it was meant to.
Sure.
I'm excited for this week's show because I really enjoyed Get Back in its entirety.
Yes,
as did I.
I think some of you, Ralph was saying the third episode was his favorite, or the third part.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think I took the most notes.
Oh. Well, let's lay it on us.
Oh, well, I mean, you know.
Right. Yeah, I feel the same way. I didn't expect there to be so much studio stuff still.
You thought it was going to go straight to the roof.
I thought it was going to be more about roof and roof preparation and, you know, possibly some tar paper.
Right.
I don't know.
All sort of roof-based.
Just generally. You know, who's the greatest baseball player of all time?
Yeah.
Babe Ruth.
Yeah. How would you describe sandpaper? Oh, that's something different. Okay. Yeah.
Well, you guys want to catch up first or swing right into it?
Yeah, I do, because I don't want this to end. I don't I felt a tremendous loss as the credits were rolling, like, oh, I guess it's over and the Beatles are dead now. Like,
yeah, there was a moment like where they finished the rooftop concert and there was the caption that they never performed together again. Uh-huh. And then like you said, when the credits rolled, it snapped you back to reality where we're in a different spot now vis-a-vis the Beatles.
I guess we're jumping right into it.
There's still 49 there's still 49 hours of footage not seen.
And I don't know if he was joking. I think it was the article I sent from Variety to you guys where he was like, there's a 22-hour version. And I was like,
oh, jeez.
I kind of want to see. And again, this is previous to a couple weeks ago, this is a part of the Beatle history that I was super not interested in because it was difficult to wade through and just in terms of volume. And now I want more. I want, because yeah. I don't know, they did such a good job.
Compared, right.
This might come as a shock to you. The Michael Lindsay Hogg version is not very good.
Yeah. So they turned you around. So basically.
Yeah. And it was kind of like you were talking about the rooftop thing. The original ends with like a freeze frame, like Paul like frozen, like doing his thing, like, oh, here we go, here comes the cops, and then like they play a little music over that, and then they're done. Just to see him like, and now we're gonna leave the roof, and now we're gonna take down the thing. Like, it was super surreal,
right?
Because a lot of that footage was very familiar, and then it just kind of expands.
It's funny because, you know, life didn't end at the end of the rooftop concert. They still had to go back down and listen to it and decide if those tracks were okay. And And George, I think it was George, was the one that was telling them, okay, now we have to figure out what other tracks need to put on the album. Like, yeah.
George Martin was like, yeah, what are we? Okay, that was a good try. And then this could lead to something else. Like he's essentially telling him, like, this isn't good enough, guys. Like, we need to do it. Like, I'm glad we have their ending. Mm. Oh, which reminds me of something else. It's like, here the Beatles are. Essentially, the frame up of the conversation is, all we've been doing is focusing on this documentary. Do we have enough songs for an album? And they're all together. They're all huddled up. They're trying to figure out what else do we have to do to make this album happen? Like, this is an album focused conversation where they're taking inventory and what's good enough. Do we have the right takes? And fucking Michael Lindsay Hogg comes up and like, yeah. And then what about the documentary, you guys? It's like, dude, read the fucking room. This is not what this is about right now. And he keeps on like needling them and they're like, yeah. And then like, they try and bring it back. They do it a couple times. Just lay off, dude. And George is like, you've got plenty of footage.
Which is true, as we know. Yeah. Try to stay on task.
I want to talk about the footage down on the street because it's not on my notes, but I'm thinking about it right now. So the footage down on the street, you have the guy interviewing, and he's like, the question is, do you know who that is on the roof?
Right.
It reminded me of that video of the social justice warrior at Chick-fil-A who orders a water at the drive-thru.
I don't think I've seen that.
So it was, he was like, do you know why I only ordered a water? It's because Chick-fil-A is an awful company with that's anti-homosexual. Right. And it's like, he's like laying into this poor drive-thru girl who's just trying to give people chicken.
Right. It's not her policy.
But the guy asking the question on the ground is so proud to be the one to explain who is on the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And you could tell like he hopes they don't say they know who that is up there, so he could explain it and break the big news that it's the Beatles,
which is the opposite. That's not how it should be.
It's like so weird.
It's better for the Beatles if everyone was like, yeah, it's the Beatles, dude, they're my favorite. It's
which even kinda... the people who hated them do. It's like, go blind, you want this, the Beatles waking me up from my nap.
Call the Bobbies.
Can I take a moment here? I would like to say that we are pro LGBTQ rights and totally feel like all corporations should treat all their employees equally, regardless of how they identify.
And don't be an asshole about it.
But also don't be an asshole.
this woman's working minimum wage. You know, she doesn't have a choice. She doesn't have the time to apply her morals. If she even knows what's going on or cares, like, it's not her fault, water guy. This dude you're talking about, Ralph, is the same equivalent of the people that go to a place specifically to not wear masks and yell at the staff about it.
Ricky Schroeder?
Did Ricky Schroeder do that?
I think Ricky Schroeder is the one that's been going to like Costco's.
It's useless. Even though this dude at the Chick-fil-A I agree with, like, you know, Chick-fil-A has purposely had an anti-LGBTQ agenda, but I don't agree with his methods.
I feel like watch the video. Yes. If you watch the video, you'll be like, oh yeah, it's like the same. Like, do you know why I didn't order any food? He asked the lady when he gets to the window.
But I also feel it's kind of a legit question too. It's like, you can't see them. They're not doing songs that anybody knows. It's not like they're doing Love You Do. It's like, oh, it's clearly the Beatles. We have 50 plus years of history knowing that they're doing the rooftop concert. It's just like, if you heard echoey rock music coming from an indistinct place and you don't know the songs and you don't know them, like, it's a legitimate question. Or if somebody's trying to pull something over on you, like if somebody's pulling a prank, like, I'll get four guitars up there and I'll just tell people it's the Beatles. But like, immediately people are like, yes, this is the Beatles. And this is Paul singing. Like, you know,
but also they have to know, like, that apple is there. Like, that's right. Where...
But it just got there. That's the thing. So we have 50 years of history.
But they had to have known.
That's the first... I'm sure it was not... I mean, but look at the fans who are out front. There's two. Necessarily throngs of folks. They just moved into that studio, which is why they were installing all the equipment and anything. I don't know of how widely known it is that in the middle of this business and financial district that, yeah, maybe the Beatles are there, but if you heard music, it's like, oh, clearly, I don't know. I don't know if there's bands that play across the street in the parking lot during COVID because there is a venue there and they moved their venue outside. Like, it just sounds like music to me. I don't know if it's really REO Speedwagon or not. Like,
is that Hootie?
It could be. Or the Blowfish.
I did like the old man that was way into the Beatles.
Yeah, me too.
He was definitely crafting his statements to be bite-worthy. I think the good lads with the solid attire.
I don't mind their hair. Moral.
I don't mind right. the hair. People do. I don't.
It was he the one that was like, he said he is, it would be okay if his daughter married one because they're rich.
Yeah,
that was very funny.
Yeah, that guy was rad.
Yeah, the whole interviews on the street thing was an interesting touch that I wasn't anticipating. And there were so many cameras on them up there on the rooftop. They were not going to miss that moment. They were loaded for bear.
Well, good for Michael Ying Hogg for doing that. I was thinking
that's the one thing he got right was to get coverage,
tons of coverage.
Peter Jackson was on. They keep on airing snippets of this interview, and on the Beatles channel, and you could tell he was being very diplomatic, and I mean, but nothing insincere. But like, oh, what about Michael Lindsay Hogg? Like, not really even that baiting. And he was like, yeah, a lot of people say this, a lot of people say that. But, you know, he shot the footage. Like,
yeah,
what you're seeing is his work. Like, this is it. I mean, he couldn't do anything with it. But, like...
I mean, but are we in a situation where if there's, what, 90 hours of footage or whatever?
I think 60 film 65. And then 150 of audio.
We could run into the, like, broken clock thing where even Michael Lindsay Hogg is right twice a day. Like,
sure.
I want to say, at the beginning, there was too much of that little girl. It's too much Helen McCartney.
I was fine with it.
I was starting to get exasperated.
I like that she, well, I mean, I'm not the one here with the daughter. So for me, I'm like, oh, that's fun. How sweet, a daughter, a little girl. I like that she was dressed as Ringo.
She kind of was, yeah.
They both had the same vest and a floral printed shirt. But I liked it. I was like, it just showed like kind of how there's some people out there that might take the Beatles like way too seriously. And we take the Beatles too seriously and we've had them impossible. On this pedestal for the last 50 years. And to them, they're just doing a thing, and letting a daughter run around is part of like probably any job, like a bring your daughter work day or something. And so it just makes it feel like, oh, they're just people doing something. It's not as precious to them.
No, I agree with that. And that's why I love all the things where it's just like, yeah, it's just them kind of fucking around or anything like that. But as a parent, I was like, we're trying to record a Beatles album. I mean,
that's the thing. It's like,
can you cram it with walnuts just for a couple of seconds? I'm not irritated. I'm not saying that. It's like, what is this annoying child? Like, I know what I would do. It's like, because I've been working from home and I have a kid running around. It's just like, I'm on a Zoom call, sweetheart. You got to be quiet. Like, daddy's recording The Long and Winding Road. Can you please play with your water wow but or whatever?
I noticed in the end credits during, I was looking at all the song credits. And she appears as a performer on whatever song that was.
Oh, that's funny.
Like, they added that's her name.
I like when she starts imitating Yoko. Like, she gets on the mic and starts doing...
screaming. Yes. Yeah.
And John totally calls her out. He's like, oh, it's Yoko. And Heather thinks it's funny. And I think Yoko kind of thinks it's funny, too.
Yoko probably thinks it's funny because it's disruptive.
And she's interested in that.
I feel like if, and again, this isn't to sandbag on top of Heather McCartney, who I don't think she was McCartney at that moment. But anyway,
yeah.
She's far more intrusive than Yoko or anybody else.
Or Linda, so like, or yeah, where's any of
the
George's...
Where's the scorn against her? Not saying that she deserves scorn, a child.
No, no.
Scorn, but it's like, broke up the if Beatles. You want to talk about people who are interfering with sessions and like really kind of potentially derailing things,
that,
it's
that's
the child
her.
That's drumming as Ringo is trying to do a take.
Exactly. Yeah. But I guess maybe it's because it's just down to that one day, hopefully. But yeah, I get what you're saying. I liked that Ringo came in with like five words for Octopus's Garden. He's like, I wrote a song, guys. It goes like this. And he's got like, you know, 4% of the song.
He needs the bridge to make it, you know, a song. Mm-hmm. And immediately George goes over and starts helping him.
That's right.
And it's the usual thing. It's like, those aren't the right chords. You'll get it soon, but those aren't the right chords. And then I thought it was interesting. So they're just kind of fucking around. And then there's, you know, some focus. And once they have something kind of going, that's when George Martin comes over like, all right, how can I assist you guys? You kind of have everything squared away.
There was a lot more George Martin this time.
Yeah, and he seemed like he was in a much better mood.
Yeah.
Totally. It's totally proportional or disproportional to the presence of Michael Lindsay Hogg. Like he was virtually not there during those studio things.
Mm-hmm.
But Glenn Johns is still calling the shots. He is the quote unquote producer. And I want to reread why that is, like why it wasn't George Martin, but he's still kind of there.
But he walks around and he has a lot more input in this part. It was all good. It felt good.
And I mean, I don't know what the studio dynamics are in the 1960s in London, England, but like he's really behaving more like an engineer, or he's like being closer to Mal than he is to Glenn. Like
mm-hmm.
Glenn is behind the console. Glenn's kind of calling the shots, saying what he needs and everything. And George was, oh, your bass is out of tune. Let me tune it for you. Which is like, I don't know if that's necessary. I wouldn't expect a producer to be doing that necessarily over Mal.
Right. Or like some tech.
Yeah. All right. That was the normal one.
No, I'm just thinking about, it's a song about being underwater with your friend, the octopus, with all your, that song is so childish.
Well, here's the thing for me, the way I see it, is this whole get back thing is them trying to get back to their roots and trying to get back from, they've already mentioned we've done the psychedelic thing.
Right.
This is Ringo being fucking two steps behind the rest of the Beatles. And now he's doing his psychedelic thing. He's like, I know psychedelic. He finally got it. And so it's like him taking 8 years to write the Goldfinger song on that Peter Sinner-Frinovich sketch. So it's Ringo showing up to the studio, Twickenham Studios, by himself and not knowing what's going on.
Right.
He always seems a couple steps behind, which is funny for someone who's supposed to be keeping good time.
He's just not a songwriter. That's the thing. You're in a band and you have,
but
you know, definitely two of the greatest, and then George is coming into his own, and it's like, well, maybe I want to write a song too. It's more innocent than that. I don't think he's like behind on the scenery thing. I just think that he's not a very good songwriter, which is
Ben's question of is it just a song about a guy hanging out with octopus friends and stuff? Yes, but I feel like it's because it's only because he figured out how to write a psychedelic song.
It's influenced by this.
Like it's
I don't think he's that savvy.
Think it's just him and a bunch of kids swimming under the water.
Well, the Beatles were, they wanted to buy an island, a Greek island. So they're out on a boat. Magic Alex says like, oh yeah, I've got the connections. He doesn't have the connections because he's a big old liar all the time. So they go out and the ship captain, as they're like driving around, is like, did you know that octopuses find, you know, shiny objects and they collect them and they have their thing? And it's like a little garden outside of their cave of all these shiny objects. And I'm going, that sounds like that would be a great song to do. Oh, I think it's just all he was just grabbing onto whatever he could. And did.
He
I
heard
don't think
something.
It was more than, yeah.
Oh, it's Ringo banging Jared Leto at the fashion show. Is that?
That's, I think that's more appropriate. I think that's more appropriate.
There's a moment that I loved.
Yes.
Ringo offers Yoko gum.
Yes.
It was amazing. So Ringo offers Yoko gum. She accepts one stick of gum and splits it in two. She
splits it in half.
One for her, one for John.
I love it.
She tries to stick it in John's face. He does not pay attention. He does not notice. So she just gently puts it into his hand. He closes his hand and accepts it. It's the craziest transaction.
It's so funny, and I love that scene so much. And she's looking at him, and he's like deep in, he's not paying
he's
attention.
Talking.
He's 100% focused. But like once his, you know, monkey brain feels an object that he recognizes in his hand, he shoves it in his mouth like a toddler. Like
yeah, I have a note about that too. It was so wholesome, and you know, if you think about it, she didn't say, "Hey Ringo, can I have one for John?" She just immediately shared what she had with John without thinking mm-hmm. about it.
Which is yeah. such a, it's so reminded me of being in high school. Like, isn't that what you did? Like,
yeah,
there was
yeah,
like this code of ethics about gum and gum sharing and things
right here,
like that.
Have some.
Oh, you rip it in half and you give the foil side to somebody else and they can have some dude. Like it was,
yeah,
it was so sweet.
One thing that I liked in this episode, and it might've started in the earlier part, is when you would get that caption, "This is the song as it appears on mm-hmm. the album, Let It Be," or mm-hmm. whatever the specific yeah. wording was. And that was, every time that came up, it was like finishing a quest in a video game or something. Just
yeah.
That sort of, it's locked in. Oh, wow, they did it. They got it. They did that one.
this whole movie is, thank you, Beatles, but your song is in another castle. Like, it's like you're not quite there yet.
You're not there yet. You need Billy Preston, or
yeah.
you have to change a couple words, like whittling.
What's it? What George was whittling? Coming in. Like you have a blank canvas, and you kind of whittle it down until it's.
Oh, like, okay. I thought it was like that was a like they used the long and whittling rod. I was like, what are you talking about?
No, I mean just like. Like, oh, but my other question was like, how do you know when you're there? Like, how do you know when to stop? It reminded me of Fight Club, because I've thought for a long time, if I were the one making Fight Club, I would be so nervous about all the references to Tyler Durden being imaginary. Spoiler alert. I would be too nervous about it. I'd be like, guys, that's too many. I've said this on the show before. I don't need to repeat myself, but that's the same question. It's like, how do you know that you've got it? Like, you don't get that caption in real life. They yeah. don't get to see the caption.
And for them, I think it's kind of hard because there's two things at play. Because normally when they record, they just have to fix the bit that isn't working for them.
Uh-huh.
And then it's done. And then it's like, okay, that one was 95% there. Let's just redo the solo and we'll do it. They can't do that. So it's like they're looking for that 100% and it's almost impossible to get that. Like there's...
Yeah.
And then when at one point George says, well, you could just edit it together. And it's like, edit? We're not doing that. We're doing live performances.
You bounder. You can.
But then exactly. But then on the other side of it is this was kind of shocking to me because the whole Beatles lore is like, this is a live album. There's no studio tricks or anything like that. But they're talking to Paul and George Martin and he says, yeah, we're thinking about adding brass and strings. It's like, whoa, that's not part of the story. The part of the story is like you're so pissed off at Phil Spector because he added all this shit to your thing. And granted, he did it in a very, I don't even know the right
murdery
for it. Shitty murdery sort of way. Yeah, like a shitty murdery.
He really murdered
and
it.
Lying about it for years.
He just
sort of way. So yeah, I'm sure if George Martin scored it would be far better and far more subtle, but it was just kind of shocking to hear that like, yeah, we're going to keep working on this and we're going to add shit to it.
Because I think there's, I was listening to a couple, my whole thing was to, I wanted to listen to the whole album once this was over, but I didn't think about it until too late. So I only heard a couple of tracks, but I swear I heard strings in one of the tracks on Let It Be.
Yeah, that's the whole, I mean, that's kind of the spoiler alert, is that they try to make this album and like nobody's comfortable with it and it's not good enough. Alan Klein comes in and it's like, okay, you guys are losing money. What can we do to make money? And it's like, well, we have this album and movie and book that like is right. really shitty and none of us want to do. George Martin doesn't want to get involved. Nobody really wants to get involved. Glenn Johns gave it a couple stabs. So what they do is they bring in Phil Spector. And in early 1970, and just adds like 20 orchestras and like a harps and a choir and all this like not Beatles shit on top of it to like make it palatable. And people have different opinions on it. John says that was the only way to make it listenable, but it's it's unlistenable. I especially the Phil Spector like overproduced songs are unlistenable to me.
Well, so does this explain Let It Be Naked? Is Let It Be Naked the Spectorless version?
That is exactly it.
Oh, I have that album, but I just didn't ever really understand.
And that's good. That album, I love listening to that album. And it's, I mean, there was some studio trickery just in terms of like equalization and mixing and things like that that they couldn't do back then. So it sounds better, but it's still a pretty and raw did album.
George,
yeah.
George Martin have his hand in that?
I don't know. Not really. He was suffering hearing loss in the last part of his life, so he turned most things over to his son or other Apple stuff, including George R. R. Martin. So I lost my train of thought to that reference.
So his son is his son Giles. His son did it,
but other studio Giles Martin, and then there's other people on Abbey Road who have been like focused on, you know, making Beatles songs sound like Beatles songs, like since Anthology. So they've got a pretty solid crew who know the formula now.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a long answer. Did I answer everything you guys wanted?
No, that was good. Thank you.
All right.
It's like only a couple years later, like maybe 5 years later, George Martin did the score to Live and Let Die.
Yeah, like four or five, yeah.
Something
because it's 1974.
Yeah.
And Paul did the titular song.
Yes, he did. The title and the titular song. And like all Paul McCartney solo songs, 2/3 of that song is great. And then there's just a weird middle part.
Are we saying
I'll take you down to the street?
Oh shit. Well, okay.
I'll take you down.
So here's the thing. I've just got notes. Okay, go ahead.
What?
I was going to say, going into this, I decided I didn't want to have actual Beatles songs as our openings to the shows. Last week I did a Beck song that's on the Paul McCartney 3 album. The week before I did the George Harrison song, Dream Away.
That's a good one.
And I did not know what I was going to do for this third episode. And now I
know.
Thank you, Ryan, for that.
I'll stop making references to it. Yeah. Well, if it launched the show, they've already heard it.
Does it have anything to do with stepping on crocodiles?
No.
When you said that, I was picturing John Cougar Mellon got like, suck it down, chili dog. stepping on crocodiles.
So is that, okay, I heard.
Yes.
In that song, when he sang sucking on chili dogs. Uh-huh. He's talking about Chili Dogs, the slush puppy's mascot. Like he's calling that.
Like the food product, right?
Yeah.
I guess so. That's super weird.
It's a hot dog with chili on it.
Which is weirder? Sucking on a chili dog or sucking on a slush puppy?
No, but it's not sucking on Slush Puppy. It's referencing Slush Puppy by its mascot. Not very well-known mascot's name. Like, I'm eating these Poppy Freshes. What is that? Oh, it's croissants, but it's Poppin' Fresh's wife that is not often seen or whatever. Like, it's so weird.
It's weird.
But so you're telling me that there might be, like, an actual explanation for that lyric?
Yeah. I don't know. They're both weird.
Yes.
But one makes a little bit more sense.
Even if it's the explanation one, really? It's still weird.
Yeah.
So we find out the name of the Toast Boy.
Yeah, we've known his name from the first episode. You guys just hate him so much.
I'm so glad we finally found out his name.
You've known this whole time.
Oh my god, yeah. the best moment for his character arc was he gets promoted from Toast Boy to Tripod or Easel. I guess it would
Music Stand.
He's holding the music for John. Just know the lyrics.
Just up there on the roof in the cold. This is very important stuff going on. And you know he's like, please don't fuck this up. Please don't fuck. Don't. I hope the paper doesn't fly away. I hope I don't get a cramp and move the paper. Like,
very put my thumb in front of a lyric.
Oh my god.
We also saw the title for Alan Parsons. Alan Parsons was titled as tape operator.
Yes.
Coast to coast, L.A. to Chicago.
Up for sale.
Okay.
Yes.
I don't remember who it was. I think it was George ordered a toy in the mail. It was a toy instrument, an electronic.
Oh, yes. Toy stylophone. Instrument.
Yeah. And they all wanted to play with it. And they handed it to Billy Preston. He gets it for about 15 seconds and then figures it out.
Right.
Totally.
He's one of those. He's one of those musicians that could just do anything.
And I'm sure in real life it took more time to get to that point, but it's again Peter Jackson's like, here's Billy Preston. He's great at everything. He fixes everything. That was great. And I wanted to hear that instrument.
And it's just amazing. Like, it's set up from the first episode that like Billy Preston is super talented and he can do anything. And that's it. There's the scene where he's playing guitar, which I don't believe we've really seen him play up until this point. And he's playing very well. And I don't know why I would be shocked by that. It's just like, oh, here's another thing that he can dominate on. But then when you look around the room during that number, what was it? Old Brown Shoe. It's Paul, George, Ringo, and Billy all on guitars. And it was just kind of a weird alternate reality where it's like, oh, this is what the Beatles might look like without John. Like, it wasn't Billy on organ. It's Billy on guitar taking John's spot as they're working through Old Brown Shoe, which I thought was cool.
I noticed my note said that Old Brown Shoe started, like, when they started playing Old Brown Shoe, and it may not be the first time they played it, but it seemed closer to finished than many of the other songs. It seemed like a full thing.
I feel like a lot of George, I mean, there's a couple examples in this one, like something where, you know, he's still trying to work through it, but I feel like whatever he walks in with is pretty far along.
He's not like as much.
He's been working on it at night and he's bringing in, or like, I've been working on this for a few months and here it is.
Yeah.
He wants their opinion, but he doesn't want them taking over. So he waits until a certain point before presenting it. And Something is my favorite Beatles song. And it's hilarious to watch them being like one word off. And for us, it's so obvious. It's so obvious. Like, how are you not getting this? Why? Like, when he says, just put cauliflower there and we'll just deal with it later or whatever. I'm like, it's so, how is it not so obvious? How is that line not obvious? You've got literally the 95% of the way.
Right.
And it's like probably the harder.
You did all the hard work and you're sitting there yelling at your TV. Come on, you idiot.
Two words.
It's not cauliflower. Sometimes I got the impression on this episode where if a song was going particularly well or had a high enough quality, it would be, oh, that's an Abbey Road song. That song's too good for Let It Be. We're going to save that one for Abbey Road.
See, I don't know. All this
that's
stuff,
the thing. I don't.
I've only listened to the Beatles when I was growing up and some here and there, like radio stuff. So I didn't know. I this whole time assumed this was the last album. But when George came in with Something, I'm like, what that album was that on?
Google it
and
up.
I'm like, oh, so, and then I go, oh, I guess Abbey Road was the last one. And I guess some people, there's like, as far as like when they're released or something, which is truly the last one. But hearing like hearing him sing something, it's not complete. And I'm like, oh, did it make it on the album? And see, it's not on the album. I'm like, oh, it led me down a path to where I realized that I had this all wrong. I thought this was the last.
Because you could tell that it didn't end up on that album, but you know that it's a song.
Yeah.
I actually, by the end of this episode, I had up on my phone the track list for both albums, Let It Be and Abbey Road.
Did you sing it? Did you sing the track list out?
That was amazing. And the fact that never made it, as far as I know, didn't make it on any versions of Get Back. Part of it is because it's inaccurate, because all those songs were never recorded during these sessions. But like, it's such a cool way to like introduce or wrap up what your album is.
Yeah.
I'm going to throw something out. This has been weighing on my mind a lot. No, not really. Just like 25 years. Is that whenever they talk Beatle history, it's very distinct. The Get Back, Let It Be project is one thing. It didn't work. They reconnect with George Martin. They say, can you produce an album like we used to produce an album? He does, and that's Abbey Road.
Right.
And it's very much framed up that way. And it's the good album. It's a good album to go out on, right? A masterpiece in the truest sense of the word. It's all the skills that they learned up to that point, exhibited perfectly, executed perfectly, production, recording, orchestration, everything. It's truly their masterpiece, a good way to cap it all off. My take, and you can even see it in the movie, where it's like nothing is very concrete. There is no like real clear, definitive, plotted out history or even takes or anything like that. Like Paul saying, yeah, let's add strings to these songs. Like previously, that wasn't a thing. It's usually
wasn't allowed.
This is going to be a pure album. And then that didn't work out and they did this other thing. It's like, no, they planned on sweetening up and doing some stuff to it. My take is that Abbey Road is just a continuation of Get Back. And they didn't bring any of the other songs forward because they didn't want to bring the other songs forward. I don't think they were quote unquote saving it necessarily for Let It Be. And I think Abbey Road is what Get Back and Let It Be turned out to be, because you kind of hear it from George Martin too, saying like, okay, so we have this and this is okay, but what are we going to do? What's the real thing? Because the time between the last Get Back session and the first Abbey Road session is 3 weeks.
That's a very
Ringo goes to film Magic Christian, and then he comes back, and now they're working with George Martin on a lot of the same songs. The songs that they worked on that are on Abbey Road that they took care of or they started working on during the Get Back sessions. She Came Through the Bathroom Window, Maxwell Silver Hammer, Golden Slumbers, Mean Mr. Mustard, Oh Darling, Polythene Pam, Her Majesty, Octopus's Garden, Old Brown Shoe, I Want You, She's So Heavy, and Something. That's like 75% of Abbey Road.
That's a lot of tracks.
Yes, and I mean, obviously some are more, you know, advanced than others. And then when you look back at, okay, well, what about the Get Back songs during that period? Get Back and Don't Let Me Down get released in April of 69 as a single.
Okay.
Almost a year before the Let It Be album comes out. It's done. Cross that one off the list. That one's out the door. That's already out there. Old Brown Shoe shows up on the B-side of Ballad of John Yoko a month later in May. They never record Across the Universe during the sessions. They kind of fumble through it or anything like that. The Across the Universe that they use on the Let It Be album is the same recording that they had already released on a charity album previously, but like modified and slowed down and augmented and stuff like that. I don't think that there were, and then when you look at the other songs, there's like a 30-second snippet of a public domain song, you know, Dig It, which is really nothing, and a couple of other things. I think that they just took what they had for that and they made an Abbey Road. And I think that Get Back and Let It Be was just in the rearview mirror until they were financially required to do something with it. Wow. That's my, and there's a lot of things that don't support that theory, but there are a lot of things that do too. And I don't think it's really that definitive, because you can see through the course of this documentary how things take paths and it's not a very linear or clear or like we're making a decision that this is what this is. It's not that clear cut in real life.
Yeah. It's a lot more organic and it's a lot more reactive than you would think. And that my understanding of how they work now, based on what I've seen, I understand what you're saying. And I think that I can get that. I can see that happening.
Do you think that this album stands out as a lesser album because they were shooting?
Because they were shooting film?
Yeah.
I think that, I mean, that's a contributing factor. The whole thing is that it was, whatever the concept was, there were so many things against the concept. The who is in charge? Well, we saw in the first episode, not really. It seems like Michael Lindsay Hogue, and he should be the last person in charge of an album. He should be in charge of the thing. But there was nobody really leading the album stuff except for Paul, right? And the timing, and Glenn Johns has to fly out and is not going to be available, and Ringo has to start, and you don't have anything, and this isn't the way we like to work. Like, there were so many things against it, but it's so to say that it's considered a less album because of the filming, I think it's bigger than that.
I feel like if they come back in 3 weeks, essentially the same people, you know, I don't think it would be a drastically different group of people, but is it when they come back, they're like, okay, now it's back to business as usual. We did that thing. Now let's get back to what we're used to.
I think
in the studio without all these fucking outside like influence. You don't have your dripping hog and cameraman everywhere, and you're not constantly mic'd. So it's more of like, okay, cool. Thank God that's over with. We can now just do our thing with
back to basics.
No, I agree. I you take that factor out and it completely changes everything. But it's also whatever the climate was that thought that they could do it and thought that they could do it without George Martin calling the shots. Like it wasn't like Michael Lindsay hogtied, some would say, George Martin, and like prevented him from doing the job. Like the Beatles kind of pushed him aside and they thought that they could do it and they thought that they can marginalize George. I think it's so much more than that. I think the film crew, while a pretty big symptom, that if you just remove that symptom, it makes everything so much better. But I think that was a symptom of a bigger issue that was going on with them at the time.
Because they broke up without a film crew around to make them stressed out.
Yeah.
So
they were even kind of going into this, and I think this was kind of shocking too, which kind of leads to the whole Abbey Road is Get Back. Is Paul's just like straight up says like at one point to Glenn Johns, it kind of throws him off. It's like, this is our last album. Like he just straight up tells him like, this is our last album. He's like, oh. And then like when Paul realizes what he says, probably to more to himself than to Glenn Johns, like, this is our last album of the songs that we're working on right now. Like some weird, like convoluted, like, oh, there might be a chance that we get back together. But I think that's what they were doing. They were trying. And you even hear that in the first episode where they're talking about, we're going to do our live TV show. We're going to read the stories. And then it's going to get to the conclusion the Beatles are broken up. There was something about this being the, if not explicitly being the objective, that this was, could potentially be their last hurrah.
That was in the back of their mind.
And they biffed it. And then they were like, okay, Joel. I mean, again, when you hear the stories, it's two distinct projects, but it's, you know, this didn't work out. Can you please produce us like you normally produce us?
So we can have a good last
produced
hurrah.
The shit out of them.
Yeah. I just going to note here that I don't exactly, because I realize I don't exactly know what produced means. My note is that when I say produced, I mean instruments that they don't play. That's what I think produced means, is when there's stuff on the album that's not John playing the guitar.
Yeah, we were talking about this at either last episode or the previous one. What a producer does today versus what a producer did 20 years ago versus what a producer did in the 1960s is way different. And even contemporary producers probably had different involvement in terms of what they were doing. I think there's things I've read where it says like a producer was more about clerical. This is our budget. This is our studio time. You have 5 days. I'm going to keep you on track. Here's your engineer. Here's your thing. And yeah, there might be some artistic influence in there.
But that's money stuff. That's mostly...
Which is... And I think we talked about that when George leaves the band. One of the first things Mal says is like, okay, George is going to work on your royalties, like figuring out what you're owed from this, like
right.
studio time and percentage and all that. Like
that's office work. That's not
work. It's very clerical, but we also know that George Martin, and again, I'm not going to say confidently that it was very different, but from what I've read, it was very different from other producers at the time, interpret their artistic request, gave them suggestions, was able to facilitate, was able to translate hums and mumbles and vague thoughts into, well, here's how we can achieve this with studio equipment or with certain instruments or whatever it is.
Or like one of John's, or a loop of something. Or
yeah, when John wanted to record Tomorrow Never Knows, he says, I want to sound like the Dalai Lama chanting on the top of a mountain out to my throngs or whatever. And you're George Martin, you're like, okay, I think I know what to do with this. We're going to push your voice through a Leslie speaker, and we're going to use tape loops, and we're going to run them through a console, and we're going to bring them up like a synthesizer. And
right. And, so it's a lot like engineering. Because when I hear a song, when I think of a song as being overproduced, I don't think, boy, somebody really took too much time figuring out the royalties on this song.
Right, exactly. And I think that's modern production. When we think about like Jimmy Jam in the 80s or
just way too many instruments going on or too many
goats in the studio.
Too many goats in the studio.
Walk Hard, which I'm sure was based on Pet Sounds, I think. What was it?
Sounds, Brian Wilson was leading those sessions. Yeah, but yeah, very much based on Pet Sounds. And then an engineer, it could be somebody working the console or right. taking notes on the tape box or making sure the microphones are adjusted or properly placed or they're the correct ones or all that sort of stuff.
Can we get into right now?
Yes.
The police officers.
Yes.
Oh my God. They need their own episode.
They kind of did we got a good 45 minutes of them. At least.
No, I mean, we need to do an episode on them. Like, we need to have our own episode on the cops. Oh,
those fresh-faced bobbies with their rosy cheeks and their chin straps.
Mouth straps
at times when they were nervous.
Yeah, nothing shows dominance and asserting authority like nibbling on your chin strap.
And this is another thing where... Yeah. This is what made me very, very glad... This is one of the times Drippin' Hog was right, was by, and I don't know if it was his idea, but to place a hidden camera in the lobby.
Uh-huh.
That was great.
It was brilliant. First of all, right. they get a shot of it, which is good. We get to see what it looked like. But to see George Martin walk in and immediately notice it and like look at the camera and smile, like they all kind of knew. Like this was something was going to happen. Nothing more apparent than, I don't want to jump ahead, but the moment when the police officers finally get to the rooftop and Paul notices is one of the greatest friggin' moments in this whole thing.
He's so happy.
It's what he wanted to happen.
Yeah. And it's like a present.
He sees it. His eyes light up and he continues singing in the mic. He's like, woo. It's like, it was so good. So, our friend Jocelyn was over last night. We were talking about the documentary. She hadn't seen it yet. So I threw on the trailer, the 3-minute long trailer. And like a lot of it, I highly recommend after watching this documentary, go watch the trailer again.
Okay.
Because it sets up the big moments. It says there's the part where John or where Paul says, I want the authorities to show up. Like there's things like that in the trailer where it's like, oh yeah, those were big moments. And the trailer set up those big moments. And that moment, I mean, but the receptionist and the doorman is like Jimmy and Doris. I don't know who they were.
Debbie.
And heroes. Jimmy, fucking every single excuse. Like, yep. I don't know if they had a list of, okay, these are everything we can counter with. This is everything we can do to keep them off the roof. to the point where, like, they had an answer for everything, but then one of the big stuffy police chief comes along, and with his mustache, and they have a new excuse, being like, "Oh, there's too many people up there. Your police officers are up there now, but it can't hold the weight of you, so you got to stay down."
You can't
like
go
every
there.
Single excuse. Oh, it's and then so the great. And then the Brian Posehn guy comes, and he's like, "Oh, it's the doors have to be locked while recording." Like every single, they had
it's so great.
It was,
and then the other thing that I thought was so awesome was then, like, to kind of diffuse that their presence. "Oh, would you like a sweet, Jimmy?" "Oh yeah, thanks, Debbie." And they're like, it's like, "Oh, I got this check here. I need to be clear."
Right. Like I'm still doing office work. This doesn't bother me.
They're still doing things. It's just like they're off in the corner. And I swear to God, like, better than any episode of The Office. All the takes of that one Bobby, what he like, what he like,
Jonah,
rolls his
the
eyes.
Jonah
the
from Veep.
It's so goddamn funny. And then what, like, again, so perfect, better than any line from The Office when he's like trying to like help solve their problem. Like, he's up against it and he's trying to find reasons. It's like, "Well, it's called to be live. It's the doing the feature." And then he throws out, "Well, maybe they could dub the sound on afterwards." Like, he's trying to like now get into film production to like to resolve this issue. But now it's going to be live.
He wants it to go away, but he knows he can't. And it constantly looks like they want to leave. They keep kind of going for the door, like, "Maybe we can just get out of this and people won't be mad when we leave."
They're just so powerful. They can't do anything. They're not making any sort of inroads. These people are not impacted by them.
Yeah.
And then he has to call, like, who is he called downtown for? The chief of command or whoever it was, using their phone because there's no radios, there's no cell phones or anything. The call box is probably down the street or, you know, traveling into a different dimension, as I've led to be learned.
They look young enough to be fans. So then is it also they're in there just listening?
They're pissed. They're pissed with how powerless they are. They're not giddy because they get to be in the Beatles thing.
They look white totally as neutered. Sheet. Not just because they're British, but because they look like complete. They're out of their element.
Because they've never been so completely stymied. That Debbie with, like Ryan was saying, every single thing, just they can't do anything. They've been completely blocked.
They're confident. The confidence between the Apple workers and the police is amazing.
Yes.
It's so good. And he has this one line, and that's all he has. He doesn't have anything. We had 30 complaints people. In minutes. He just keeps saying over and over again. It's like,
but the 30 people. And we're like, okay, the Beatles are on the roof performing.
And then they do this shot, and it's so quick. I tried to get a still of it, but it's so, so quick. So they're up on the roof. I think they wrap up "Don't Let Me Down," and they immediately launch and get back so they can't be stopped.
Yeah.
And what's his name? The doughy guy just like looks straight at the camera like Jim Halpert, and he just like rolls his eyes like, "I can't fucking believe they're doing another song. I thought that they were going to stop." And all he could do was roll his eyes.
But it was like all Paul. Paul was so excited cops being showing up that he's like, "Oh, we finished our song. Fuck it. I'm just going to start playing Get Back." And of course the Beatles are like, "All right, here we go.
It's Get Back."
And John's pissed because he shut off his amp, but he's also pissed because he can't play the guitar anymore because his hands are frozen.
Like, yeah.
He's having a hard time during that last song, but he's just pissed because I think he's pissed at Mal, like, "No, what the fuck are you doing? Like, why are you doing what the cops are telling you to do? Don't turn on my
George,
amp."
Was it George that plugged the amp back in?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always thought it was George's amp, but maybe it was both of theirs. Because you definitely see John flip his on. "No, they turned it off."
Yeah, it's and there's also a moment where it seems like a total reversal of what we expect from these guys, where Paul is the one advocating for anarchy, and John almost wants to submit. The Bobbies show up and John's saying, "Oh, the jig is up. Time to go back inside."
And I think that's more about like John just not giving, like, it's not that important to it. Like, oh, all right, I guess we're not going to do this thing that none of us really wanted to do anymore.
and then like, Paul just playing full volume, full energy, Get Back, just starting it up and just going crazy. He's so excited.
He wants it.
And then the doorman makes his way up to the roof, and there's like a brief shot of him. And the cops are up there, he's up there. And this guy could not be smiling anymore. Like, like, we fucking did it. We did. He's just beaming.
They got at least 3 extra songs out of it compared to when the Bobbies would have liked them to stop.
Well, when they first showed up, I think they were only in their like 2nd or 3rd song. Like, they were just getting started.
I was thinking, what if this was like Ocean's 11 and the Bobbies get to the roof. And it's empty. There's just one amp. And the Beatles have constructed a green screen roof replica in Las Vegas where they were really playing. And it's a wide shot. The camera pulls back, helicopter shot of the 2 Bobbies on the roof looking around.
And the hologram of Eddie Izzard shows up.
Yes. Sorry, your Beatles are in a different castle.
Twice. There was a bit where Ringo was asleep and the camera caught him the moment he woke up.
That was great.
That was so good. And there's another part where Ringo said, "I farted."
Yeah.
It was all British. Like, and then he's like, I just wanted to give you a heads up, like, or whatever, like that.
But was it during like Hogg trying to like, do another like meeting, and Paul was clearly not happy with
not
it.
Into it.
And
yeah.
So
and George Martin was just like sitting on the ground with him. Like,
George Martin says, "I'll light a cigar."
Yeah,
so fucking fight. I hope it was a protest fart to Michael Lindsay Hogg, and it wasn't just something that snuck out.
I just thought it was a way to derail the conversation.
Oh yeah, that was great.
Did we ever find out what was the deal with Paul's big old fancy meeting he had to leave for?
I wrote that down and that was hilarious. I don't know, because when he first says it, he says, John has a meeting and I also have a meeting at 1:30, but made it very clear that they were 2 separate meetings.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if that was his meeting with his personal meeting with Alan Klein. I'm sure it's noted someplace, but it was not immediately apparent. And I thought it was like the biggest Shaggy Dog, awesome thing. Like, Paul's meeting. Paul's got to go to his meeting. But it's just a meeting. It's just whatever. It's just like, as it relates to the documentary, just fucking business. No big deal.
It's kind of like the, what was it on Ministry of Science Theater 2000, the space movie where everyone's talking about Debbie's birthday later.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever it was.
Oh my god, she died.
Did you say Debbie's car?
Space
who
Mini.
Space Mini. Thank you. I couldn't remember what it was called.
Highly recommend that episode if anybody hasn't seen it. I might watch it.
That might be a good starter episode, you know. It's
good. It's pretty solid all the way through.
Yeah.
Yeah. Calgon.
John sings a song. They're rehearsing. They're rehearsing a song, and John gets the news that he's divorced. Yoko's divorced.
That Yoko's divorce papers have gone through. Now Yoko is now divorced,
and then he sings about it. And that song is on Anthology.
That is correct,
because I'm familiar with that track. So yes. That was interesting too. Oh, and I also think I've thought about this actually about the Beatles before we even watched this, is that, you know, sometimes they'll do an ad lib in a song. Mm-hmm. And watching this, you come to realize how they do ad lib all the time until they decide what the ad lib is that's going to be part of the song. And then it's like set in stone. I will always go woo.
There was a point on the rooftop where John forgot the words.
Oh, yes.
Saying a bunch of nonsense. Then George was like laughing about it.
Yes.
And then when the phrase was going to repeat, Paul stared at John.
Yes.
To make sure he got the words right this time. And I very much enjoyed it. It's like that sort of like, it just shows dynamics. Like it's almost like Paul has to have the most respect towards the songs he wrote. And George doesn't give a shit about Paul and John's songs. So.
Well, I think he does. He just doesn't like to not be listened to. Like, he wants to help out.
But he likes, he laughs at the fact that John fucked up the song. Like, it's.
When Paul looks over at John, I think it's more about, it's sort of like, what the characters in SNL, Kristen Wiig and Fred Armisen, where they make up the songs. Yeah. I think it's more about Paul, like, I'm going to watch John to see what he's going to say so I can harmonize with him correctly. And if he says, blee, blah, blah, ba, doo, 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 I can do something like also kind of similarly mumbly. Like, I think he's watching, like, what are you going to say? Because I have to sing harmony with you right now.
Right. That's fine.
The other thing, and I want to devote some time to this later and I don't want to do it now, but there's a moment when they're doing the playback and they're listening to Don't Let Me Down Again. And the camera coincidentally perfectly is on George when John fucks up that part. And like, George is really into the song and to the point where he does something like, oh, John's about to fuck up right now. I'm going to hear it again. And he hears it almost like for the first time. And he like kind of recoils a little bit and like smiles and like looks over at John like, what the fuck did you do? It's all funny to him again. And it's also, and it catches him off guard because he's so in the moment listening.
Right.
I love it.
I have one more note, and it has to do with the credits. So,
okay. I have 30 notes. So okay. What do you want to do? How about you, Ben?
I've got a couple more. Like the one that I just found is that George says John told him once you start writing a song, finish it. And yes, that sort of ties in with what we said, that that seems to be George's philosophy. And John says, that's good advice, but I can't do it.
It's funny. When I'm glad you said that. I thought that it was Paul who said, not because of that, because I know historically that's something Paul said. Oh, let's just get it done, guys. We got the studio. Let's do two songs today. Why not? And so I didn't pick up that that was John who was saying that too. So I don't know if that was like John trying to caught Paul's mantra and then saying like, yeah, and I can't do that.
And there was one shot of George and he was engaged in a conversation. He was smiling. He was just being himself. And he sees out of the corner of his eye and turns and sees the camera and just like shuts down. And if I could get that as a gift, that would be the one that shows you how much knowing the cameras were there must have been a bummer for them.
Totally. Mm. Especially him.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And then this is my last notice. Because what's an interesting choice by Jackson is it's very linear. We go throughout the calendar, we go to the rooftop concert, we finish the rooftop concert. There's more after that, which is, it adds to the emotion of the piece because you know that much as this was a peak, business still went on as usual. And then after even that, he takes us back to Twickenham.
It's not Twickenham.
It's not.
That's Apple. And the funny thing is because the original film is presented in a slightly different order chronologically, and maybe it was just me not being smart enough to pick up on it or anything like that. And because the film grain and the exposure is so bad, I'd always assumed that those songs were recorded in Twickenham because it's just black.
Yeah.
But they had just relit the studio. It's the Apple studio just relit. And I didn't know that until watching this.
I'll be damned. Seems like there was less people around too, but
I think that's just for the shot and everything, like they're doing their show. So
wow, okay. Well, there you go. So it might still be linear, but so this changes my note because I thought they were back at Twickenham. I said they nailed down at least two of the tracks before George left the band, but no, clearly they did these two tracks after the rooftop concert.
Yeah,
and my last note is they were singing in German. And I said, it looks like the Beatles know a little German.
They do know a little German.
Sitting right over there.
And of course,
he gets up, takes his hat off, and waves. As if he can hear their conversation.
Right. He knows they're talking about him. He's a little German with good hearing.
He knows where his camera is. He knows where his light is.
That's right.
Did you know that the Beatles recorded I Want to Hold Your Hand and She Loves You in German?
I did know that. Yeah.
Which I think is the inspiration behind in at the end of That Thing You Do when he's telling what's his name about all his contractual obligations. One of his like, you have to record That Thing You Do in Spanish. Like that he's like going through. It's like, hey, I have to appeal to the foreign markets, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, are we ready for lightning round?
Well, let me do my last note, which takes place during the credits. There is a VFX credit. There's VFX credits, and this is separate from the film restoration credits. So I'm still in the camp. It's a camp of one.
Digital Mouse.
Of Digital Mouse.
There was a scene that I went back and watched because something didn't look right to me when they're having a conversation.
I'm fine with the Digital Mouth because, again, 57 hours of footage and 157 hours of audio.
Right.
You can't just do cutaway shots. You can't just continue to use shots of people with a microphone in front of their mouth. Like,
right. But I feel like in day one or episode one, like they were very clearly like,
yeah,
their mouths aren't in sync. Like this is footage from something else. They're not trying to do, right. This is just, I don't know if you would call it B-roll in a technical sense, but it's just like, this is just appropriate footage that aligns with the disclaimer that they put up front that they'll put visuals with the audio that doesn't have.
Right.
Film footage. But there was absolutely something that looked like they had digital mouths. And I went back and watched it a couple of times. And I mean, I don't know for sure, but like, it just looked like what it was the artifacts of them with their degraining process or whatever that is. It didn't necessarily look like, you know, on Conan when Robert Smigel's lips would like pop on top of something. Like
it, well, here's what I have to say about that. I think digital mouths, if they used it, one, it's not deceptive. You know, it's not, they're not trying to make us think that these people said something they didn't say. They're using actual footage of the actual people and actual audio of the actual people. So that's fine. And two, I think it was subtle enough that even with the three of us looking for it, we can barely even prove it.
I don't know. I feel like if this is a documentary and you're documenting what happens and you're not explicitly saying that this is a recreation or something like that, I feel like that is deceptive. And
it is.
Not
it is
like I think anything is, but I mean, there's other ways to communicate besides what you're saying. There's body language. There's who else is in the room. Would you say that when this person was there? Would you not say that they were there? I think there's much more than that. So if you're representing something like this is a conversation that this John and Paul had where they fucking rip George apart, not saying that that's happened. Right. And George happens to be in that footage, but he wasn't there at that conversation. That, that changes things. And I don't think it's that egregious.
But you've made a good point.
I feel like if there are I'm not saying definitively or anything like that, but I feel like it would violate a lot of the, I guess, the ethics behind
the conceit of a documentary
and the things that they align to throughout the rest of it. So why would they make an exception for this scene? You know,
maybe Heather McCartney was CGI.
She actually was.
Maybe that was the VFX. Yeah,
they were going to replace her with a pork.
All right, hit us with lightning round, bro.
Okay. Here we go. First one. This one hit me hard. This is a me thing. I love Strawberry Fields Forever. I don't have a favorite Beatles song, but like that's probably one that like got me into the obsession. One of the first bootlegs I bought when I was a teenager was every take and every mix of Strawberry Fields Forever through its development process, right?
Just a big one for you.
And it also goes in that category of this is a song that the Beatles never performed live. This is a studio song. They never performed it live. You never see them performing it live. And there's a scene. And you see them do Love Me Do. You see them do all their, like, go dip into the well and do all these old songs. Yeah, but then when they bust out Strawberry Fields Forever, and it's not done, like, as a serious take or anything. It's like, this is it. This is the only time you see the Beatles doing, you know, probably one of their best songs. And
what's great is I think like Peter Jackson is a big enough fan to know that. And that's why it's in there.
That's intentional.
It totally hit me because I mean, at this point, you know, you've been watching them do snippets of their old songs for like 8 hours at this point. mm-hmm. you know, you're used to it. It's part of what you're in. It totally got me.
That, oh yeah. Nice.
That was good. Glenn John's referring to something as being very tasty. Like all of his adjectives were very, very funny to me. That's tasty. Very tasty. That's very tasty.
All right.
Billy Preston. During what song
Esquire.
Was it? Billy Preston Esquire is
so good.
Sitting. He's playing the piano with his left hand and reading the newspaper with his right, but he's like still doing a good job. I thought that was terrific. Like, I'll give it my 100% when you guys need to. He's it's only been a few days and he's already over the Beatles to some extent. Paul's meeting we talked about.
Oh, I couldn't do that because sometimes if I'm talking, I end up typing when I'm talking. I feel like he might start playing the news on the piano.
They turn to the other camera.
My favorite joke in Airplane.
I love it.
It is.
It's my favorite joke.
You're not wrong.
So
this is just this is something
they're using. He's using like a drum to relay the news because that's what the technology will allow. Yet they have two cameras. It's so fucking hilarious. And then on the back, instead of having a screen, it's just a painting on a scroll of a plane crashing. It's so fucking good.
But the special bulletin comes in. They don't hand him new sheet music. They hand him new drumsticks.
Yes.
And he plays a slightly higher
xylophone
or whatever.
And the button is that they have two cameras and he turns towards it. It's so amazing.
Looks at it. Yeah. That's
amazing.
That's a tight,
straight face.
Tightly packed bit with like a lot of
good.
A lot of good in it.
Oh.
Okay.
Something I had to do a little research on, but I thought it was a good story. There's George Martin is interacting with somebody and Paul says that George Martin is overstepping his bounds and John cops an attitude and says he's going to teach George Martin a lesson. And he says, remember Bob Wooler, and everybody laughs. So apparently, this is the truth. Bob Wooler was the manager of the Cavern Club. And was asked by the Beatles to be their first manager, and he declined. But he introduced the Beatles to Brian Epstein, and they've had a cordial relationship. They were having a birthday party for Paul, 21st birthday. The Beatles are already famous at this point, left Liverpool. And apparently this guy made a crack at John, allegedly, about him and Brian Epstein having an affair together, which is a rumor that exists out there. But apparently did not use very kind or flattering terms when he said that. So afterwards, this gentleman needed medical attention and also received a hefty payout from John Lennon so that he would not go to jail. So he says, remember Bob Wooler, I'm going to kick your ass too if you don't watch out, George Martin.
He's going to beat you up and toss some money at you.
I thought some of the things when they're talking to, they're in the control room, they're talking to Glenn Johns about Alan Klein. You could kind of tell that Glenn Johns is testing the waters to see how they really feel about him. And the adjectives he used, he's very strange. He's very clever. Like these very low, like on paper, kind of innocent terms where he's like trying to get a beat for him. Like, I don't fucking like this guy. And then when it gets down to it, it's like, oh, he's great, great, really great, great. He's like, he might be great to you, but when people like me have to work with him, this guy's an asshole. So you might want to consider that. we talked about the TV show, about the last album. What else do we got? What else? The cops.
And the cops, by the way, were named by the Chirons and yes. the captions and everything because their names are like a matter of record. These yes. dudes had names. It was, I guess that's the difference between like a documentary and a movie because to me they were just cop number PC number one, PC number two, and sergeant.
How can you say that after the impact they had on this episode? They get a chunk of that documentary, and I wanted more.
Yeah, but it just, I don't know. It wasn't throughout the show. It wasn't like when the episode was over, I still thought that. But just the moment when their names came up, it struck me
It's like, you're not Alan Parsons.
Yeah, right. I don't know exactly. Who you are. Yeah,
you're not Frightened Cop number one and Frightened Cop number two.
Basically, but, yeah.
So have these guys been interviewed since?
I bet they. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they even like.
And he's like, "Oh no, yeah, I knew what was going on. I knew what was going on. I didn't want to interrupt. We got 30 calls and complaints, but we wanted to give him a little breathing room. Yeah, whatever, dude. You.
I think Ryan's right. I think that I would not be hugely surprised to see them at like a con with a booth, like come.
Wouldn't you want a picture with him?
Yeah.
Rolling his eyes at you? Like,
the strap in his mouth.
Last formal note that I have is they're in the Apple studio. They're running through Let It Be. The camera focuses on John, who's lip syncing. Could be interpreted as making fun of Paul. The lyrics. He's like staring right at the camera and he's like lip syncing along with Paul. And then he starts playing like when he needs to play because he only has his two notes that he keeps on complaining about. So it's John totally fucking around and him and Yoko kind of fucking around. And then it pans back to a wide shot. It's like, this is the version that appears on the album. So this one where he's just like kind of dicking around and not doing anything. It's like, that was the best one.
He nailed it.
He's totally nailed it.
While being a dick.
I was kind of gutted at the end of this.
Yeah.
In a way. And the backstory of this is when I first heard that they were going to do this, I was not on board. That I thought that this was going to be Paul revisionism and trying to put everybody in the best light. And this isn't my favorite album. It's not my favorite collection of songs. I don't like the final product. Don't like the outtakes. Don't like anything about it. When they're down and they're listening to the playback from the rooftop to kind of strategize what they're going to do next, and it almost turns into home movies and they're excited and you've been through this all with them. It was such a good feeling. And then it abruptly cut, like it's all very intentional the way that's structured. Like it kind of takes the wind out of you a little bit because you're in this moment of after having endured whatever's gone out on through the month of January. You know, there is a moment of happiness and a success about what they have done and everything like that. The way it sets up and chronologically they present it, the loud songs were on the roof and then they were going to run through the quiet songs downstairs. So there's essentially another concert, but it's not defined by like, okay, it's going to be 45 minutes run straight through. It's kind of a hybrid of a recording session and just kind of going through the songs. Mm-hmm. So the fact that I was initially perplexed that they didn't give those songs their due the same way they gave the rooftop concert their due. Like they only play Let It Be and Long and Winding Road for they don't play the entire songs. It's like, this is the final one of the album. This is the final one of the album. This is the final one of the album. And ultimately, like when I realized what was going on, I hit pause to realize, are they just getting the credits out of the way so that we can have one final concert and it ends with the Long and Winding Road and then the Apple logo and we're all happy. When I realized that wasn't going to happen, it kind of makes sense for that because it would have been just another day in the studio.
Right.
You know, which we've already seen up to that point. So I was a little upset. It's like, okay, well, we saw all these other songs. The other thing that kind of struck me about this is the rooftop footage is more complete here than it's ever been presented before. But I mean, a lot of the key things are represented, not new to me. But when you, and I knew the story, but now that you've experienced what it, just a slice of what it really was like, every facial expression, every note uttered, everything just had so much more weight attached to it. It wasn't just like, this is two of us and he's kind of fucking this up, or don't let me down and he kind of fucked it up and that's kind of fine. Everything means so much more. For that, and it was just one of those things where it was again 100% familiar with the footage, but the weight attached to it, the amount that I enjoyed it was so much more than what I could ever imagine it being.
the context.
So I have a couple questions. Now, are you happier that it was that this footage for this movie was for this album because you didn't care for it? Like you, like if it was an album you liked and then you got to see sort of how the sausage was made, you'd be like, oh, it changes something. And does it change it for the, like, does it make you appreciate the album more? I don't know if you're going to go and listen to it, but so it on the other end of this thing that you didn't want to happen and you were kind of not really for, on the other end of it, it's changed you.
It absolutely has. And it definitely gives me it. There's enough context now where I don't know if I'm going to, it's hard to say, but like, I definitely will appreciate it more, but it's also saying something that like, in order for this album to like kind of hit you, you have to watch a 9-hour documentary to understand what a fucking, like there's that part of it too. Right. But I mean, there's a good, Two of Us is a good song. There's good songs on there, and there's also
They're Beatles good songs
performed. They're Beatles songs.
Yeah,
some of them not performed great, and then there's some kind of clunkers on there too. And
they're not all great, like throughout though. I mean, is there an album that you let every single song is good?
Revolver all day. Okay.
Revolver. I like Rubber Soul. I heard Ralph talking about that last week. Yeah,
it's the thing is like even a shitty Star Wars movie, you still get to see lightsabers. What's funny about this is, so like, we really only see the end product. We watched a television show recently that we're just like, oh, it sucked. It's awful. We sat there and watched an hour a week and we're like, oh, that was stupid. Yet someone who produced it is like, we went through all of this stuff. A lot of decisions were made and this is something that we thought was good enough to put out. So now it's like, Get Back is like, oh, it was just an album. It's something I can listen to in 40 minutes and I don't care for it. But now that you see sort of you were now part of that process by sitting through just 8 hours of a full 3 weeks of work.
Right.
Like it gives you it gives you a new perspective. And I think that's kind of cool.
It's interesting. Yeah.
And I'm glad that Ryan, I mean, I'm not going to say that you're like the biggest fan of Let It Be now, but
no.
I do like that this experience allowed you to appreciate it more.
Totally. Absolutely.
Because something that's been around for 50 years, you really don't get a lot of new things.
Information I mean, about it.
No. And even like the information, I knew a lot of that stuff, but just... You know, there's something about reading it as a sentence in a book versus the now I'm watching the 45 minutes that sentence represents. Like that's a huge difference. It's like, yeah, Paul and George got into a fight. I've seen the footage of it, but to see all of the footage of it is just, like, it changes everything.
It's unprecedented. It's unprecedented for us to have this much information about these people in this environment. And it, you know, the work that was done to make it, as good as it turned out was, I think, admirable. I have nothing to complain about this documentary series.
My obsession, like where it was like so focused, probably ebbed greatly 20 years ago, where I would have to buy everything, read every book, be there at midnight to buy that, like all that sort of, that's long gone.
Right.
But watch, and again, this is not something that I like. Watching this again, immediately, I just want to watch it again. Like, I want to be obsessive about this. Like, I want to, just because I haven't fully processed it yet, even though, you know, I took notes and watched it and then talked to you guys for over close to 4 or 5 hours on this. Like, that still isn't enough. I want to go back and I want to watch it again. I'll do a rewatch. We'll do a rewatch podcast. Why not?
And that's all the endorsement you need to give. That shows.
Yeah.
If you want to watch something again, if you want to talk about it, if you spend a lot of time thinking about it, to me, that's an effective piece of art. And people say that the purpose of art is to invoke emotions. They did that for sure.
It was amazing. It was amazing. It was so well done, and it was all the level of intimacy with the subject and all that is, I can't think of anything that's comparable.
Mm-hmm. I think we had the discussion last week about whether it's eligible for what awards it might be eligible for. I hope they find something, because I believe this to be worthy of being an award-winning piece.
Yeah, I don't know what the, like, usually has to have like a run in a theater or something, which I knew they did like a screening of El Capitan's, but I don't know if that qualifies for that. It like has to run for a week or like there's parameters.
I'm sure Disney would figure it out
if they want to do it, but it's 9 hours.
That's a lot of hours.
It's a lot of hours. It gets a special award.
That's kind of how it needs to be presented. It needs to be presented as this sort of day-to-day grind that guys were going through.
Yeah.
Like when you see Ringo looking tired, you feel it for him.
You know why he's tired, because you've been there.
Yeah. And I remember when the first thing you said, Ralph, like when we got started on the first episode, is like, they need to get back to the editing room is what they need to do. And I was right there with you where it's just like, this is too much. Who's going to enjoy this? Like,
yeah.
But now I want more. I want the 22-hour version. Like,
I see it.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it has to do with that reward of, you know what's coming. You're just, for me, it was waiting for the rooftop. For you, it might have been something different. Yeah. But we all were kind of rooting for them, even though we knew it happened. And I guess because we know it happened, that they're going to do the rooftop concert, that you kind of sit there and you're like, I'm going to go through this grind along with them, because I know at the end of this road, there's going to be, you know, this big thing that happens.
Right.
Right.
At the end of this long and winding road.
Which came in super late. I was watching it the whole time. It's like, when are they gonna get the fireworks factory? Like, I know that song's on the album. I know they perform it. It like came in like 2 days before.
Right.
Yeah.
The contrast though is the boys don't know that. You the three of us know that this report is coming, but the poor lads don't have that guarantee. So I guess it's even more. That's why it's more important when it does happen.
And that's what's great about that moment where the producer, somebody tells or gives Paul the idea about doing it on the roof.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we should have, there should be just a real quick cut. I'd like to see a real quick cut of the producer giving Paul that idea and his beautiful reaction. Them starting off playing, and then when the Bobbies show up and Paul notices them.
Yeah.
Just like the, yeah.
That would be like a 3-minute delightful video.
Or just, I was thinking you were going to do the Jared Leto stills.
Yeah, like, you could definitely do this,
and then Paul getting excited, like, they're here.
That's right.
About that, the article that I sent you, it's like, about Michael Lindsay Hogg, was like, Michael Lindsay Hogg says that he came up with the idea to have the Beatles on the roof. And then, like, not quite a contradiction, it's like, the film footage shows Glenn Johns pointing up to the roof to Michael Lindsay. Like, Glenn Johns came up with the idea. But Glenn Johns came up with the idea
probably because he's like, I can run wire that far.
Yes. Yes.
I think that's something else. We could talk about this probably for another hour. Sorry, James. But it's like, there's so much about the Beatles. I don't want to say that's about laziness, but it's like,
efficiency.
They don't care. They don't care about the things that people normally care about. Their outfits that they're wearing up on the roof are iconic. Iconic enough that when anybody parodies them, whoever's on drums is wearing a red slicker, and whoever's playing guitar is wearing a fur coat if you're Barney Gumble or Peter Serafin or whoever it is, right?
Right.
They were down in the antechamber. They didn't even know if they were going to do it or not. They decided at the last minute. John and Ringo are like, we're too cold. So Maureen Starkey gives Ringo her slicker. John gets her thing. Like, it wasn't, but now it's an iconic moment.
Yes.
And it's like, we're going to do a big concert. Of course you're going to do a big concert. The Rolling Stones are trying to do the big thing. They've got a set and it looks like a circus and they're all dressed up. What are you going to do, Beatles? I don't know, Libya, or I don't know, the Roundhouse, or I don't know, the Roof. And then it becomes more iconic than whatever ideal shit they could come together.
Right. The, like,
that's what I'm saying about this whole thing. Is that we are making it iconic. They're just trying to get their shit done.
That's just
their
day. And it doesn't
matter. Nothing matters to them. The only thing that matters is that Paul wants to get arrested.
Or John wants to be warm.
But I think it becomes iconic because it isn't what you would expect or what anybody would plan to do. It's different. Like,
and that's what made me crazy. That's what made me crazy about the guy doing the interviews on the street. Do you know who that is up there?
He was
trying to make it iconic.
Right. It's
obscene. Get him off there.
And the one girl didn't know who it was. That one girl's like, I don't buy Beatles albums, huh? Who?
Is this Herman and the Hermits? I don't know. Sorry, just to kind of wrap it up, I thought that I didn't have a chance to finish. I'm not blaming anybody. I just where the conversation went. That the gut punch that I got at the end of this, where it was like, you've been involved in every aspect up until this point. You hear the playback. They're going to come back in the next day. You don't get to, like, I think there's a practical storytelling element. It's like, you've seen all this shit before. You don't need to do it. But I think it's also like, it's the door getting closed on you. It's like the Beatles have had this, you know, wall around them that they built that you don't get to see what's going on and everything like that. We're not going to show you everything because you're on your way out. We're closing the door on you. Yep. They recorded and they finished the album. We're going to summarize, you know, a 16 hour day in about 5 minutes. They drive home safely, have a good night. Like, it's almost a way to kind of like push you back out of the Beatles circle in a very deliberate way, like wanting to know more. Like, oh, I want to see how the rest of the album comes out. It's like, you've seen enough, it's fine, we're gonna close. Like, I think that there was something very deliberate about how that was all framed up, and that you don't have access to them anymore. You don't have access to the rest of how this album was made.
That's thinking, really interesting.
And have the droid's memory wiped.
And have the droid's memory wiped. It's kind of like that. It's kind of like that.
It's like Godfather. Like, where
it's totally like Godfather.
They're literally closing the door. Like, we had our moment and now we got to go. We're not allowed underground anymore.
And it's shocking because, again, knowing what happens, it's like, okay, they've got half the album to record today. It's like, yeah, but you guys don't.
Yeah, but you don't need to see that.
You guys don't need to see that.
They swatted the fly that was on the wall, buddy.
Yes.
That was us.
Did we do that? Does that mean anything?
No, just because it was such a fly on the wall thing. And then now.
Oh, they swatted the fly on the wall. I thought there was a literal fly on a literal wall that I didn't know.
With 60 hours of footage, there might as well be. A lot of things can happen in that time.
So are we doing this again next week? Are we gonna do our rewatch? Done.
We're gonna watch them in backwards order.
I'm excited. I'm excited because this is my last podcast recording of the year.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah. My Star Wars show, we got enough of a buffer where, like, in 2 weeks I have an episode to drop that's already edited and all that stuff. So it's nice. It's nice to have a break.
Yes.
But then Boba Fett starts and we're doing live episodes of that. So.
Oh, we are?
If you want to, come on. It's going to be live.
I have nothing to say. It's like, that's cool. That's like I don't know any EU things.
Well, in the latest, like they did a commercial, a little tiny commercial. And Boba Fett walks into a room, which is the same set as the deleted Tashi Station scene.
Oh yeah,
ooh! So he's a Tashi.
That's awesome. And I said,
does he pick up some power converters?
He might. No, I don't know yet.
He fixes the cable.
To be revealed. As far as Darmalars goes, I don't know what we're going to be up to. I don't know if there's anything on the horizon. Sweet Tooth, I'm assuming season 2 will come out sooner than later.
Sure.
They're going to have to take time to shoot it, I'm sure.
I heard Why the Last Man may be picked up for a non-FFX straight to Hulu thing. Sure. Sorry, we won't be covering that.
That's right.
Let us know how that goes.
It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen.
It can't happen. I can't imagine it happening.
You know that really expensive thing that didn't make an impact? Let's do more of that. I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, I don't see it coming around.
I won't see it coming around. that show is at a crossroads. I should know. I watched to the very end.
And it's burned into my screen because of how long it was on there.
And you've got a plasma. That's how bad it is.
I can't talk about it now or on with the mics on, but you guys know.
Oh, shit.
I have
work.
A project I'm working on. Officially starts in September. And I didn't know.
That's in the past.
This coming September 2022.
Oh, okay, that makes more sense. Okay.
And for those listening, it's Lost related, so that's exciting.
Oh.
But I can't talk about it. But it's going to be eating up a lot of my time. So we'll see. We'll see how when we return, Darmalars wise. I mean, right now for me, Sweet Tooth. I can't wait. I can't wait for more Sweet Tooth. I'm trying to think of anything in the near future coming up. I really don't know.
How about Ben and I have a podcast and we talk about what you can't talk about because we haven't signed anything. We'll just talk about your shit.
I know. But
until you're ready to
I'm very excited about it.
The NDA podcast.
It's the biggest thing that I've worked on. And so I'm very, very, very excited, but I have to really, really focus up on it. I feel like, if we go in September, it's because I did a fair amount of prep.
Oh, I see.
And I feel like the project, the person I'm working on this project with can just be like, maybe I don't want to do it. So I want to come up with a big enough case to get things rolling in September. So, I don't want to talk about it just yet, but,
so you want to do your pre-work.
You
have an obligation for September, but that doesn't mean that you're going to be coasting until then.
Right. Right. So,
well, we'll see if something comes up. There's always something, you know, if you have time, if there's something to watch, then we'll do something.
Sure.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, Ben and I will do the Ralph Shit podcast where we just talk about your shit and you're not there.
Can you if my shit's really long, can you whittle it down to like 11 minutes? Can I just say something really because he's listening?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do
it. Very much enjoy the Darmalars Roundup by James. Very much so. I think it is a really fun way to highlight some of the more fun comments from this show.
Yes,
it's a great commercial to be like, hey, look what you're missing. They're like, this is, listen how fun this is. Get a load of this show. You should go check it out. It's great. But the way it was presented was the opposite way. Like, I like this show, but don't listen to all of it. I think just that's what the hang up is. But for the most part, like, as you know, if someone hasn't listened to the show, and go listen to that and you'll see why you should listen to it.
Right. Yeah. It's a commercial. It works. It's just the initial framing seemed a little backwards.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's our inspiration. Brandon and I will get together and do the Ralph Roundup where we talk about all your other podcasts, and then maybe sometimes we'll get a special guest star on like you to talk about what we just talked about, which is you.
Honestly, it's just the Star Wars one. So,
but I mean, collectively, how many podcasts have you been on this year? How many, either Ralph initiated or Ralph guest star?
Kaiju podcast has been done for a year.
So we're going to count that. We count that.
Oh,
we're counting that one. Okay. Geek Dad Life,
which is not my podcast. I have literally
it isn't, but you are on it. Right. You were on it the entire time. Or whichever one, the one that he does the live one on Thursdays that you do.
Yeah, Screen Geeks.
Screen Geeks, yes. I apologize.
I'm doing that on Saturday. Next Saturday, we're talking about Spider-Man.
Yeah, so big old lie when you said you were done this year.
Yeah, you lied to us.
But I don't, that's the thing is I only have to like show up and have a conversation.
You don't have
to post
it.
I don't know, as opposed edit to or post or edit, and I don't have to do any of that stuff.
I still think it counts. I only appear on it for the entirety of the podcast and on every episode. I don't know why people time
it. But it's like it's only like an hour of one day.
Don't diminish it. Don't hide your light under a bushel. Just
when this recording is done, I gotta go do a bunch of shit with it. I'll probably edit out the stuff where I say I like what James is doing.
Yeah, don't give him the satisfaction. Asshole.
Maybe I just won't post this one.
No, but then that would make me sad. Then what but you don't listen to him. That was the joke.
There's All Right, Let's Do a Podcast with Kevin. Yes. And that happens once every couple months.
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. It. Still a podcast.
I have my Patreon.
Yes.
Thanks to them. Thanks to them, this podcast is commercial free. Except for last week's commercial. You didn't listen to last week's, did you?
I didn't. I never do.
I did.
Did you enjoy the sponsor?
You fucking suck up.
Well, the thing is, Ben, it was me and Ben for the first half, me and Ryan for the majority of the second half. And so there's stuff that you didn't hear, Ryan, that you didn't live through.
That's about fine. Me and I'm good with
it
that.
Was the thing you said you wanted, me and Ben, only me and Ben talking about the Beatles without you interfering. It's there
and
for
how
you
was
to listen
that?
To.
You can listen to it.
Okay. But in between,
by the way, I say that I listen to the show, that is not sucking up. I'm always ashamed to admit that, and not because I'm ashamed of the show, because it just seems so fucked up to listen to your own show. I know there's got to be something wrong with that.
There is, because I used to listen to, like, especially when I was like early on when I was helping with QC and things like that, like mixing, I would want to listen to it just from like a quality control standpoint, like what did I do right, what did I do wrong. Now I don't mix the show anymore, and
no one does.
And I lived it. Like, I think that's the thing. I lived it. Like, maybe I'll come back to this in a couple of years and recall a conversation that we got, a 2-hour conversation that we had about Get Back, but I don't need that next week.
Yeah.
But you guys do who are listening. Listen more.
But
subscribe to Screen Geeks. Smash that buzzer or whatever.
Smash that buzzer.
I do like that both Ben and I, A, lived through it, and B, still listen to the whole show instead of just the 11 minutes.
That's true.
There are
dedication.
It's
dedication.
So are you saying that you don't think you want to mess around until you're done with your project?
I don't know. I'm saying right now, as far as Darmler is concerned, I mean, obviously 100% we're coming back for Sweet Tooth. That is a guarantee. Okay. If Sweet Tooth drops in September.
Right. Then that might be a problem.
Then it might be, okay, Ryan, you want to do QC and mixing? I'll show up for the record and love it. But
we're interchangeable anyway in many people's lives, so it's fine.
But the whole thing was, I don't know what's on the horizon.
Right. Well, I have one pitch.
What's your pitch?
My one pitch for the year would be Sandman.
Okay.
Which is a TV series based on a comic book, which I've read.
Right. And I believe it's on
Netflix. It ticks
Netflix.
All the boxes.
Right.
It's on Netflix, right?
Yes. Neil Gaiman.
I hear what you're saying. I want to do something episodic. I want to do something that has a weekly drop or is staggered. Because I always feel it's
a show.
Oh, is it?
It's a show.
No, but it's on Netflix. Is it going to drop all at the same time?
Sweet Tooth, we went at our own pace.
I know, and I didn't like it.
You'd rather do
something.
I always feel
it's like, okay, well, you guys have all talked about this 2 months ago. You've experienced it, but we haven't moved on. I don't know. That's just my own.
Okay.
Once Michael Lindsay Hogg gets out of here, we can talk about this.
What's great is if we're doing Sandman,
yes,
one week at a time, and people watch ahead of us, they can say, hey guys, this is getting into Y territory. You can record it anytime.
That would be great to get the.
Yeah, here's the thing about that. We knew we were in Y territory when we were in the middle of Y territory, and even though I begged you guys to ditch, that nobody wants to hear us be crabby for we 6 weeks.
And what was your reward for making it through it? Beatles. I guess that was awesome.
I guess the great Beatles documentary. I suppose so. Well, what's on the other side of this shit heap? What are we gonna? What's my reward for this?
We'll see. We'll see. Maybe it'll be. I don't know. They'll find footage for Revolver.
Right. Well.
The last
see man. You around the clubs.
I'm saying Darmalars will return in question mark.
We'll see. That's right.
In Moonraker.
Yeah. Ooh. You seen No Time to Die?
No.
No. In fact, when you said that thing, I was like, oh, it's now on digital. It's like, I did not even realize it had come out in theaters.
It's about as long as an episode of Get Back. Doesn't feel that long, though. It's good. It's good.
Well.
Cool.
See you around the clubs.
Again. All right. Yeah. Yes, you're around the clubs. Trash cans.
See you around the clubs, guys.
You guys don't want to stop.
We're not dying.
See you around the clubs.
No.
Tell your sister, see you around the clubs.
We'll be back next week with two Bobbies.
the two Bobbies podcast.
I do want to get back to the two Bobbies. That's good. We should do like a watch through where we just watch all their scenes and then we comment on them in real time and then pause if we need to.
All right. Well, I'm going to stop recording.
Yeah.
Oh, I should do that too. Am I the one holding up the proceedings? 1, 2, 3.
Recording stopped.
Got it.
Now that you don't have to consent to. You don't have to tell it. Got it. When it stops recording.
I tell it. Got it. Anyway.
Got it.
Have a happy Christmas. You got it.
Yeah, you too. You can feel free to lop off as much of the end of that as you want.
Fuck it.
Okay.
All right,
guys.
Later. See you.
Bye.
Anyway, peace and love, peace and love.